All right, my name is Dave Sieg, and I have a company called ZFX. I just noticed that my audio is not plugged into anything. I don't know if it should be. Somebody might want to look at that. I'd like to ask a few questions if I can, just to get to know my audience a little bit better. How many of you are from Cleveland? Just a few. How many of you came from more than 100 miles away to get here? Wow. And how many of you are here? Is this your first one of these that you've attended? Okay, great. All right, now this one's probably going to be a little bit more difficult. I want you to think for a moment about what the earliest computer animation you can think of that you're aware of. Does anybody want to mention something they think is really old? Electric Company, that's a good example.
Evening Magazine.
What magazine?
Evening Magazine.
I'm not familiar with that. You mean an animated open for, okay. Okay, somebody's been looking at the website, I think. Okay, well, those are good examples. What I'm going to try to do today, and I've got a lot of movies to show, and it's not that I'm trying to get out of being a presenter, but I've got some interesting things I think you'd like to see. And I'm going to try to give you a little bit of a history of computer animation. For those of you who are in academia, I'm not starting with the ancient Greeks. I'm skipping a whole lot of things, and I'm not giving credit to a whole lot of people that probably deserve credit, but I'm kind of giving you a personal tour of the field that I've been involved with. And what I like to do is start out, a lot of people don't realize how we got where we are now, how all this got started. And I'd like to show you a couple of things that in the process of looking through this, I have learned for myself, and I think you'll be interested in. I'm going to try to talk over this and adjust sound levels at the same time, so I apologize if we have a little... Do you have audio?
One of the most dangerous threats to our nation's security is the possibility of attack by high-speed enemy bombers armed with nuclear weapons.
This is really the beginning of computer graphics, computer animation, believe it or not. After World War II, we realized there was a big impact with things like radar. And one of the problems was that we had things like missiles coming at the speed of sound. We had radar that we could see them with, but it was really more than anybody could keep track of to try to deal with all of that input, plot things, draw on a grease pencil on a piece of glass with a grease pencil. And it was really more than anybody could handle.
And
we also had a military-industrial complex that was hungry for something new to do. And so,
in a mass raid, high-speed bombers could be in on us before we could determine their tracks. And then it would be too late to act.
So this is from a film that IBM did partly to promote Whirlwind. Now, I'm going to cut to another thing here. There was a guy named Ivan Sutherland who was at MIT. And he said, well, you know, the same technology that's on a radar screen we could use to move these little lines around. And there are a lot of interesting things that we could do with that that go way beyond what a radar system can do.
What I've done is I regarded that first picture as a master.
He's given a little demonstration of Sketchpad, which was probably the first computer graphics program. And he's talking about how you can instance objects, you can scale objects.
Several times. This is, of course, very instrumental for repetitive drawings like circuit diagrams or bridge bays. Well, we have several repetitive structures.
Oh, if you were drawing a circuit diagram, you might have little resistors or transistors or something already drawn and stored away, and you could call up as many of those as you wanted.
Right. Now, imagine that when I was doing my design work, I made a mistake in my math. I can reduce this drawing slightly. And let me call up a copy of that master drawing again. Put it over the center there. Oops.
This all seemed like child's play at first, but then he starts talking about the fact that this page would be
already
like 2 miles big.
You're looking at the whole piece of paper. So
and
correct.
So the scale factor comes in.
And now it's magnified, so it's practically off the screen.
So it wasn't long before somebody got the idea of, well, we could use all this computer technology and graphics stuff.
Picture within a picture.
To keep track of air traffic.
Right, it's real nightmare material.
And as it gets smaller, even though the spot
and the threat of
sort of
something coming over the
really
poles
still there, isn't it?
Carrying
right.
a nuclear
the
weapon.
It's all memorized in its memory.
There's enough to get the government interested
known
in
as
using
the Lincoln
this technology.
Laboratory.
Okay, you can pull it down.
Here,
now.
The most advanced technology was applied to all
so this
aspects
is the Lincoln
of the
laboratory.
Problem of air defense.
And the government
of particular value was the use made of an already existing electronic computer. Whirlwind
this is probably
one,
the biggest
the Navy
application
financed
of
digital
computers
computer,
to do graphics.
A remarkably rapid computing
to give
machine.
You an idea, in 1956
it quickly
dollars,
proved that computers could be used to process large quantities of air defense data
program.
And to do it at
Not
high speed.
Many people realize that we spent that much
out
money.
Out of Whirlwind
One,
after additional months of research
but
and
they
development,
had 27
evolved a new electronic computer, larger
full of racks,
and much
full of
faster.
Vacuum tubes that used
this new
many,
computer,
many megawatts of
built
power.
To become the nerve center of a defense
and
network,
these computers drove
is able to perform all the complex
CRT
mathematical
displays.
Problems involved in countering a mass
in
enemy
just
raid.
A second. And they were interactive.
It receives the information.
So the operator could sit there and zoom
store,
and scroll.
Or utilizes it immediately.
Find targets, and they actually had punch
cards. Speed, altitude, and
all the
course
domestic
of aircraft,
airline flights.
And enables
so
operators
they knew
to identify
this was
the friendly as
flight,
and
this was something
what they
that we don't
to
know
Sage,
what it is.
Defense system of the United
and the idea
States
was,
Air Force.
By spending all this money,
here is a Sage Center on 24-hour
we could track
hour
this
alert.
And actually
at its heart
feel
is a
safe
computer,
about it.
Developed by a research team from MIT and IBM,
something
working with
the
Air Force. The Sage computer speeds the information for decisions by man in our missile age.
This was also the
every
first time
scheduled
that
flight across American frontiers
they
is recorded
used
ahead of time on IBM
as an
punch cards,
device.
Then fed into the Sage computer.
And
now the
computer operator
can
could
draw
aim
a
this
of
thing,
what
it was like a gun
to be in the sky at
a target
moment.
On the screen, and
it
would
it
come
continually
back and
compares
tell him this is such and such, or this is
with
an
the
unknown,
real
unknown
picture
target.
As seen by radar. If a flying object does not belong, it appears on this viewing screen. There's one now at the right of the screen. They call it a blip, unknown
these flying
are vector
object. Displays.
Friend definitely. Or foe. Within right. seconds, the Air Force will know. The officer fires a light gun at the target blip. This tells the computer to...
The situation display also indicates that the interceptors are assigned to track A-137. I indicates interceptor aircraft. G, that tracking is good. 1, the number of the controlling weapons director. 2, the number of the intercept director. A vector symbol indicates the heading of the fighters as they fly toward the point at which interception will take place. RL-15 is the intercept flight code number. Thus, the intercept director has the information he needs to direct his portion
of the final decision. Fire.
Everybody should
at the
have
moment of launching,
buttons.
The Beaumont missile receives instructions from the IBM computer. As the missile screams toward target, radar keeps on tracking. With electronic control, the computer automatically adjusts the missile to meet any change in the target flight. There is no escape.
Okay, so that's really how computer graphics got started. That's how it got into the mainstream. That's how it got involved in the military. And a lot of things grew out of that. Now, I'm going to kind of skip a lot of the other history that you can read in other places and talk a little bit about a particular man and a particular company. There was a guy named Lee Harrison that knew some people that were working on this stuff and said, well, that's really interesting, but I would really like to see this move more in an artistic direction, because I think there's got to be a tremendous power here to do something interesting. Now, I worked for a company in Hollywood, I'm kind of jumping ahead, that had some machines called Scanimate that this guy invented. And at the time, I didn't know anything about all this history. And because of the situation, the company that I worked for was not really allowed to communicate with his company. It's a complicated story, but I had to piece together a lot of this information. So many years later, a guy that I used to work with contacted me and said, I have the last one of these machines, and they're going to put it in the dumpster. So being the fool that I am, I went and hauled the machine back. It's like 6 racks worth of equipment, and have had some interesting experiences as a result. But I put up a website about it many, many years ago. It's been 15 years ago now. And I was just amazed at the response that I got. People found it on their own. They either said, I used to watch this stuff on TV when I was a kid, or I used to work for a company that had one of these, or I used to work for a company that made commercials and we did work there. I got responses from all over the world. At one time, there were 8 of these machines in different locations around the world. And so I tried to piece together the background on this guy and on this machine. And a few years ago, I took a trip out west and stopped in Dallas and interviewed one of the engineers. I stopped in Denver and interviewed a bunch of the people that worked there. I stopped in Los Angeles and interviewed a bunch of the people that I used to work with. And the result of that is on a DVD that I produced about this machine. So I'm going to show you, I know we're short on time here, I'm going to show you some excerpts from that about how this machine came to be. You'll probably see Lee Harrison's wife. Lee died a few years ago, which made it even more complicated to figure it out. But I'd like to show you a little bit of that now.
Using parts that they had gotten from Philco, because Philco was moving from one place to another. They didn't want to catalog and move all these parts, so they would dump them away. And Lee would take a lunchbox or a briefcase empty in the morning and bring it back full in the evening with resistors and I don't know what all.
When he got Ed Teichman to back up his idea of how to do animation on television, it really was a cutting-edge idea.
Lee had great ideas about what everything could be done. We had to pare down what he would like to do to what we thought was possible.
Nobody had any money, so we couldn't buy parts. But they, with these pieces, they created what he called a bone generator on an oscilloscope. And with that, he could control these bones. Then he thought he would put skin on the bones.
Stretching and pulling and bending is really the substance of Lee's belief.
But they worked first in our attic, then we moved, so they worked in our sunroom. And there wasn't any other heat in the sunroom except for the machines as they turned them on of an evening.
Bill Altimus was an engineer, I think, that sort of did some of the engineering. They did some of the first stick men to get more of the back men. There was just one little stick and a couple of feet that wiggled back and forth.
Right.
And that was the first thing they had.
We moved to Colorado in 1965. Lee was working for the Denver Research Institute at that time. And I think that's where he met Ed Teichman.
Then he finally got, I guess, enough backing to make a company to do this. We started Animac and got it trying to do things. We were mostly Lissajou patterns at that time. We made men like that man dancing from a harness that was made on Animac. I remember building that character. And Duke actually danced with potentiometers on it.
Oh, this is Jim?
Yeah. Then later on, we got another character there, and they brought in, when we were doing more promotion, they brought in the dancer from Hollywood and had her put the potentiometers on her and all, and had her move. Well, that didn't work quite as well because she was a dancer, and she wanted to show what she could do, and she moved more than our equipment. She kept breaking the circuits and stuff because she kicked higher than we thought was possible and do other things, trying to show off.
To Lee, the dream was the most important thing, but the people were a close second because he knew he could never achieve it without them.
One of the people here, the salesman, said, well, if you can animate a letter, we'll make all kinds of money. You just need to animate letters. So from that, we did use Animac as a test bed to do some moving of scan rasters and got an old little camera, industrial, and were able to use it to intensify the raster and move it around. So that was sort of the thought behind doing Scanimate.
Lee had tried to sell his ideas to Hanna-Barbera, to Walt Disney. Everybody said, you know, come back when you can do it right. Or don't bother me, we've got it, we're doing it right.
But we actually promoted Scanimate in New York. I remember taking building one of the first ones up, packing it in boxes, and we took it into New York, and Alan Stanley had set up a hotel there, and set up a reception or something, invited a lot of people in. And that was sort of one of those things that didn't know what was going to happen or anything. We just packed it up and went there.
Not exactly a portable system, is it?
Well, when we built it, at first it was more portable. We just had like a 5-foot rack with a slant of maybe 3 foot of rack space, and that was the Scanimate was in there. And then mostly just showing on the face of the Scanimate on the screen. We didn't have any video at that time. So we were actually doing all film initially, shoot with the 16mm cameras. When the company was having financial problems and they wanted to go to Los Angeles, and that's when they had Tommy Smothers on board. He was a director.
We moved to California in 1970 and back in 1972. The whole idea of the move was that we were going to where the market was.
And we actually then built 2 Scanimates, moved them into a part of Tommy Smothers' buildings, and that sort of became the basis for Image West. He lent a name there, and he was supporting, and we did some good work for her. He used to have the Smothers Brothers Summer Session or so. It was a big program. They were going to do a lot of work for that, but they got they were doing a lot of spoofing of the political President Nixon and so forth, and all of a sudden they were canceled.
I was never just sure when Lee was coming home for dinner, if he was coming home for dinner, or if he would be bringing lots of other people. And it could be people like Chuck Jones or Jim Henson or John Stone, who worked with Jim Henson.
And I remember doing some things for CTW. And we'd animate the letter numbers 4 and various other things like that. We'd have a sequence set up, and to make it go, we'd have people timed up there. Okay, now, you have to throw switches to make things happen to me, because it was harder to edit the film, to take more cost and everything, so we tried to do it in one pass. We had no way of recording video at that time. There weren't any kind of commercial type recorders except quads. That was it. We didn't have any quads. We didn't have the money. It cost like $100,000, and we didn't have anything like that.
It was very difficult for the people in development to stay ahead of the people in sales. People in sales would sell something and then they'd quick have to develop the machinery or the technology to do that.
That was the one problem with the production facility, which we had to have. We were actually trying to develop machines, but they were so unique, nobody knew how to use them, so we had to show them how to use them. Every time we designed the system, I was the first operator because no one knew what to do with it. And I would train somebody else, and pretty soon they were off and running and doing much more than I could do. I might animations were, I'm an engineer, so I like regular things and I like things to be organized and get people in there that were artistic. And man, it looks, you know, it's wild, it's different, but it comes out and, you know, gives a good effect.
Okay, so your comment about the electric company was pretty close to the subject matter here. The company continued to grow. It's really phenomenal when you look at the history, because for almost 10 years, and these days 10 years is a long time in technology, but for almost 10 years, if you saw computer animation on television, it came from one of the 8 Scanimate computers that Computer Image built. There was one in New York, one in LA, one in Sydney, Australia, one in the Netherlands, one in Japan. And people would come from all over the world to use this machine. And it was, by today's standards, you know, relatively primitive in that, you know, you had to have all these videotape machines rolling, playing back layers that you composited together, and then you would put one more layer on top of it. And then you'd play those back, and you'd put one more layer on top of that. And so what it meant was that everything had to really be designed ahead of time, had to be completely planned out, and the machine itself was entirely analog. You had oscillators, you had ramp generators, you had multipliers, you had summing amps, you had potentiometers and gain pots. And so the animators literally had a notebook of circuits. And if you need to build a star field, put these patches in these holes and turn these knobs this way and adjust this until you get that, and there's your star field. And the really painful part about it was that a client would come in and do something and walk out with the tape, and then he'd come back the next day and go, well, you know, it's just about perfect, but we just need this one little thing changed. Well, if you had to basically start over, and what you came out with was never anywhere close to what you had done the day before, because it's analog. There's no storage medium at all. So it was a really interesting place to work, and that was really my first job in Hollywood, was working at the company where they had 2 of these. So I'd like to jump ahead a little bit to a point when this was really kind of in its heyday, and we had a lot of big clients, and there were a lot of important things that we had done. We did a scene in the first Star Wars film. And a guy came in one day and said, can you do this live for a show that's going out to America live? And that was rather daunting, but we figured out how to do it. And I'd like to show you a little interview with one of the guys I worked with about that particular show.
Ready. Okay, 20 seconds. Stand by, Dick. Stand by, music. And stand by, VTRA.
Quiet, everybody. Here we go.
If you've not been involved with the live show, you'll learn a lot listening to the intercom conversation.
10 to CBS Net.
Right. Stand by to fade up on 1, stand by announce. 3, 2, 1, up announce.
Live from the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, the 20th Annual Grammy Award Show.
In 1977, Image West used their Scanimate analog computers to produce live, real-time animation for the Grammy Awards, something that had never been done before.
Boston Sciences presents its annual Grammy Awards for artistry and excellence in the field of recorded entertainment in the past year.
I have with me on the phone Roy Weinstock, who was one of the animators that worked on that project. And Roy, tell me a little bit about what it was like to work with the Scanimate.
The game of animating on that box was a client would come in and you never met the guy, and he would ask for something you had never made before. So it's okay, I've got this toolbox in front of me. What am I going to do? I'll try this, I'll try that. And then a lot of times you'd have to back up and go, well, that's not working. I'll try, you know, and proceed down another path. And, you know, within a couple hours, you'd have something lashed together that kind of approximated what he was asking for. And, you know, in those days, they looked very good. You know, first generation, never going to tape.
Yeah. Well, I know Image West had done some work with Marty Pesetta.
Marty, who I guess was the TD, came out to our place. And I guess through that whole process, he saw that, you know, it's not rocket science and that it is so spontaneous. And what he saw what it could do, and he said, well, you know, what would be involved in trying to do this live? And we just sort of went through the mental exercise and figured out that it was indeed quite doable.
So CBS had never done anything like this before.
This is the days before ADOs or any sort of DVE at all. So we would just build on black, just from his description of what he wanted. We would pre-produce effects, key it in there, and it would look great.
You know, by today's standards, we find it hard to believe, but in those days, you couldn't just have a graphic that moved on the air unless it was pre-recorded or shot on film.
That's true. Well, the ADOs hadn't been out there yet.
Well, so tell me about the effects that we see on the tape.
Some of the effects were pre-produced, but it was the nominees and the winners that were done live.
So tell me a little bit about this amazing recording that I found among my archives.
Well, I remember when we were doing the Grammys that we were recording the program out, and we had Channel 1 getting program audio.
Natalie Cole, Crosby, Stills and Nash, The Dancing Machine, Crystal Gayle, Roberta Flack.
And Channel 2 was the, what do they call it, the PL. And you could hear New York, you could hear the 14 cameras that were at the Palladium, you could hear the guys in the truck. And for us, it was a real novelty because we were in post-production. We never actually saw that kind of stuff go down.
It's getting so loud in that headset that we're like down towards the end of the show. Let's cool it a little, huh?
Yeah, well,
preset the dancers.
It worked fine. Everything is all right.
I understand. You're just a little bit late in the roll. That's okay.
Did you have, like, a list of who the winners were so you knew beforehand?
No, not at all. I forgot who was in it all now, but they would announce the first person, and, you know, he would yell down the PLs, you know, cue graphics. I had two of them on one side of the room, and Russ had two of them on the other side of the room, and we would throw the right switch.
Okay, so that just kind of gives you a little taste of what it was like to do something like that live. Any questions so far? Okay. Well, I'll... Yeah, and really a lot of those were set up so that the programming was relatively simple. You may have noticed a little CRT. The way the system worked was it took raster, which is basically two sawtooth waveforms, and put it as a display of video on the screen. But then if you add oscillators to it, you can start to warp it or make it roll around like a cylinder. And so a lot of what they were doing there was just applying oscillators and then taking them away. In fact, one of the effects that Scanimate was almost infamous for, we called it spaghetti. And that's basically where you have, and this is really what got it started. That Sesame Street and the Electric Company, the Electric Company grew out of almost entirely, somebody saw Scanimate one day and said, wow, we could do a whole series around this. And you apply these oscillators and it takes something like the number 4 and starts to twist it around in all these spirograph patterns. Quick, you switch the artwork and then take it away and it comes back and it's the letter A. And that was called spaghetti, and for years that was a really big deal in the effects business. By today's standard, it's kind of hard to imagine that, but.
For that live presentation.
For that live presentation, how did you say they had a total of 4 Scanimates going?
2 Scanimates.
And so they had physical, the images were just basically with a black line art printed on paper, or
yeah,
and they would
there were
on
light
easels.
Tables, and we would make what we call codaliths, which is the high contrast black and white film. It's clear or opaque, and you put it on the light table and you'd get everything lined up. One of the examples that gets used over and over here, because there was very little example footage, they had a 1-9 and an 8-1. From back in 1981. And so they split those up. Each Scanimate could count so many lines and have one set of parameters for those lines, and then so many lines and a different set. So you could really have 5 words on one piece of artwork, and then you could make 5 of them come out separately or do different animations as they resolve.
Okay.
So, you know, if you look at the early footage, the guy had all these amazing Lissajou things and the harness with the motion capture. What good was it? Nobody wanted to pay any money for it. And literally the sales guy saying, well, if you could make a word move, that would be a big deal. And you know, today we don't think anything of that. Everything you see is things flipping around and twisting and words moving. There's a time there wasn't a motion graphics business at all. And so that's kind of the niche that these machines filled. And to me, what's really more interesting than the machines and the technology is just some of the social aspects of it, some of the stories of the people that worked at these companies. And that's part of what I tried to capture, because having worked at a company like that, I saw firsthand some of what people were going through in trying to run a business that was technology related, that had to do with the creative aspects, that had to do with the business aspects and keeping the clients happy. And those three things really fight against each other in any business. And the same was true in this business. I'm going to give you a little taste of this, and we'll just have to see how much time we have, because I've got a lot of material and I know there's another presentation in here.
When I first saw it, I thought it was the most amazing machine I'd ever seen. When I first saw the Scanimate, I thought, my God, this thing can do anything. All our prayers are answered. It's going to solve world famine. It's fantastic. Do you want to know what happened after that? Then I started to work for Image West.
Anyway, Jeff had been out to L.A. and he'd been to Image West. And he was very impressed with it, because the guy we worked for was like Captain Queeg. You know, he's just a nutcase. So he said he'd met this guy that looked like a Wookiee. His name was Ross. So I had I got in touch with these people, and they invited me to come out, and if they were happy with me, they'd give me a job. So I went out there and I met this guy, Brian Ross, who didn't look anything like a Wookiee. And then I met this guy named Russ. He looked exactly like a Wookiee.
I guess I can really incriminate myself because I got hired with a tape I had. I like to think it was a tape I had made at CalArts, but I got hired because I came in, and I don't exactly remember the day, but it was afternoon, somewhere about 3:30, 4 o'clock. I'd gone to a couple other facilities. I come in, and I'm watching these guys work. So I was there for about a half an hour, I want to say, and then Roy all of a sudden reaches down to the ground and goes, "Whose is this?" And he pulls up a reefer that I had had in my shirt pocket and had accidentally fallen out. So now, any other place, you know, you might have never gotten a job, but that assured me being hired.
I asked Sonny, can you help me find a job out here? He says, you look around everywhere you want first, and once you've satisfied yourself that you just can't get a job, then I'll get you a job at Image West.
When I came in, Scanimate was, I had to learn Scanimate from Roy Weinstock. Roy was a tough teacher. But he was very good. I mean, he really knew that box inside and out.
I guess Roy hasn't shown up, so we can, you know, say, you know, I was hired because Roy had laid down and, you know, on the ground in front of a client and said he wasn't getting up until the client made up his mind. And so consequently, I got hired.
When I went for my interview, Sonny said, go talk to Brian. So I went to Brian's office. He says, well, Sonny says you're okay. Here's what you're going to get. I said, don't you want to see my reel? He said, nah, Sonny says you're all right.
Watch those guys work, especially Russ, because Russ would not give me the time of day.
It was just so fascinating. I came from the film school. I was into video graphics and the Takabe video synthesizer and all this sort of gearhead stuff, but nothing prepared me for what the Scanimate was and what it could do with the simple manipulation of high-resolution CRTs. The reason I took the job on the Scanimate is because you could do a job in an entire day. So I figured if I'm gonna, you know, cut my teeth and work for a while in the computer graphics industry, it would be better to end up with working for a couple of years and having 200 or 300 pieces to choose from, as opposed to the companies doing it on film, where you would do one 30-second spot in about 3 to 6 months.
So I used to watch these guys work, and when they would break for lunch, I would run out. And we almost get to the book now, because I would run out and copy on a piece of paper their patches. So I would see what they were doing, copy their patches. Of course, I would have no idea of the fine detail of how they had tweaked any of the scopes, you know, any of the knobs, or, you know, I could copy all the buttons down and what patches went to where. But still, I would go, then I would stay, and after hours, I would go in and try to recreate the animation I had seen these guys do.
I just love the real-time nature of it, you know, just doing the interacting with it, twiddling with it, seeing it in real time.
Roy would go over it a couple of times with you. He'd be very patient, and when you asked him again, he would not be quite as patient. He would catch me sometimes when I'm just kind of lounging around, chatting. He'd say, you really don't know how to run that box well enough. Maybe you better get in there and play while it's open. And, you know, he was a good teacher, but a tough one.
But honestly, it wasn't until Russ Mayo, which was, again, a purely selfish reason on his part. He ended up working an entire weekend and decided he never wanted to have to work a weekend. I think, yet again, it was for Mexican clients. And he never wanted again have to work a weekend for foreign clients. And he then taught me Scanimate. So I could work the weekends and the long hours.
Jay Giuliano did some good stuff when I first went there. Once I saw what he did, I was always good at second guessing, you know. So I sort of second guessed what Joe was doing, and, you know, just to steal from everybody else and make it a little bit shinier or trashier or whatever you want to call it. Trashy stuff was in those days.
One of my memorable things, again, coming from CalArts, where it was the art world and we were going to do these art things,
going into the commercial world was an awakening, if you will. And my famous one was, I remember, I think it was from Mars Advertising, was putting a glow on toilet paper. And glows were a very big part of our business. And I knew, that's when I knew I had really gone commercial, was when I glowed toilet paper.
The salespeople really didn't have too much of an idea how any of this stuff worked. I didn't know how any of this stuff worked. I was the director and doing the things. But basically, all I needed to do was make sure it looked all right. I didn't care how you got there. But there was a basic lack of knowledge with anyone, unless you actually ran this machine. Because it was very complicated. It was.
We already heard this.
Some things were. You have. Some things are very easy to do, and some things are impossible. And the guys that did the selling rarely knew the difference.
And so you would sit there with the client, and you would sit there, and the job essentially, I want to say, revolved around the art director and the animator. The animator was on. He was in the hot seat, while the art director could, you know, keep the clients at bay and figure out the next thing to do.
$1,500 an hour it was in those days. And that was fun, being closed in a room with the client and some surly tape ops and TDs.
The clients would actually sit in with you while you did your work, and they were on the clock, so it was all being billed. Your time was being billed in real time. They were charging $1,500 an hour. They were paying me $15,000 a year. So basically, they made my entire salary in 10 hours of my time.
The thing that impressed me most about Image West is, compared to the other kind of low-level television production I had done, is that Image West used the design aspect of it was what really sold. The way Sonny King and Joe Giuliano and Gary McKinnon could design, flowchart these jobs, so that you basically had a roadmap as a storyboard sitting there before you when you started the job. And that was always a great starting point. That was something I'd never really been involved with, having designers do this kind of stuff.
So it was really, the pressure was on. I mean, you were definitely in the hot seat, because you had to get this thing done, because the client was right there, and if anything was going wrong, you had to figure out what to fix right there at the time as the client was watching you. And for about a year, and it took me about 3 months to get up to speed to figure out how to make electronic voltages create these images that the clients wanted. After that 3 months was over, then pretty much Pete Cazera and I were the only two Scanimate animators in the shop, and they tried to keep it open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So the Scanimate represented a period. It's just like film on an optical printer. You had to plan. You don't go in with something like that and start turning knobs and hope to get a great result. You have to know what the hell you want ahead of time, or you're in a lot of trouble. So the Scanimate represented that level of precision and design at a time when video graphics was definitely in its infancy, if you could even say it existed at all.
Okay, we're running a little short on time here, so I'm going to skip a couple of things. But I wanted to kind of talk about something that's become near and dear to my heart. In the process of doing this, I had to do a lot of research and try to dig up some of this old footage. And back in those days, a lot of things were recorded on 2-inch thick quad tape that ran on $100,000 machines. There's a lot of that material still on shelves in various dungeons and archives and places. But the problem is, you can't find a machine that can play it. And this is one of the problems that we run into with a lot of things. I mean, I found a lot of things that were on 1-inch tape. And back when I was more involved with this, 1-inch was a big deal. You can't even find 1-inch machines anymore. So recently, well, it's explained here in the tape. A friend of mine is an engineer who used to work with these machines. And he's begun to collect them and restore them and keep them working. And I recorded a little bit here in his basement that we'll
60s and 70s. This was 1 hour of videotape. It was on a giant reel that contains an hour's worth of 2-inch tape.
I thought just finding a working playback machine, my problem was solved, but Larry explained it's not quite that simple.
Well, the problem is, they came up with this back protectant that's made out of foam. And over time, the adhesive that glue they use to glue this to the metal reel, it breaks down or it decomposes or something happens, and it just turns into a liquid state, and it oozes out through these little holes that have been punched in the foam. Mm-hmm. And of course, when it gets to that point, it's sticky like molasses, and it gets, you know, all down in the tape. And if you can see some of these little imprints here, that's where this glue has leached down into the tape. This is an Ampex VR 1200. Originally, it was a 1967 VR 1200.
Well, should we fire it up?
Yeah, it's gonna get noisy.
If you have one of these in your basement, you don't need to run.
What I'm not showing you is about 6 hours of cleaning that Larry did on this tape to get rid of that gooey stuff that dripped down from the foam. I didn't think you really wanted to see that.
This is the video head drum. This is the vacuum guide for the tape. Now this is the control track head. These are the audio and the cue heads.
So I guess the point that I'm trying to make showing you this is that a lot of material, even though somebody has tried to save it and archive it, when they get ready to play it, they're not going to have a machine that can play it. And even if they do have the machine, they may find that the reel that it was stored on has dripped that gooey stuff down into the tape, and the tape is useless. So when you look at, when you think about the legacy that we have, all these things from back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that are part of the video generation, that material may all be gone.
Well, that looks pretty good. See that? That tape has still got a little bit of that sticky adhesive on it.
Yeah. So that's a reel that came from Computer Image, and I was pretty lucky that I was able to get it acquired. It's pretty good. All right, any questions so far? All right. Not sure which of these I have left to show you would make more sense. I'll jump ahead a little bit. One of the things that I've done recently, a company out in Los Angeles called and said, well, you know, we're wanting to do some retro graphics that look like the 70s, and we saw your website and we thought, what better way than to use the actual machine that used to do a lot of this work? And but the project was in high definition. In fact, it was even beyond that. It was at 4K resolution. So we put our heads together and came up with a way to shoot with a RED digital camera. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, but it's a very expensive, state-of-the-art camera that's used a lot now in digital cinematography. And what we found is that the image that's on the CRT of the Scanimate held up really well. And so we shot the face of the CRT on the Scanimate at 4K resolution, and they put together their final product, and they loved it. They said, you know, we've tried with all the plugins that we can find to make something that looks the same way, and there's just no comparison. There's nothing that looks the same way that this analog light coming off of this CRT with these real-time controls look. So I'm kind of thinking there may still be some life left in the old Scanimate. And so what I thought I would show you, this is not a 4K resolution file. They wouldn't actually let me have a 4K resolution file, but I thought I would show you just a glimpse of the work that they did with the Scanimate with this red digital camera at 4K resolution. And it's still, I guess, able to do. This is for the dot milk. Short and sweet. Okay, so that's really, I've got a lot more material, but we don't have enough time. I've done two DVDs. The first one, basically when I got the machine and saw that there was all this interest in it, I began to collect up old demo reels that had been made with the Scanimate and just put together kind of a history of what was done when on these different companies' demo reels. Put them on the website. A lot of people liked them and bought them. I've never done any promotion or advertising, but I've sold a lot of them. And when I did this documentary, went out west and interviewed all these people about their experiences with Scanimate, I put together a DVD with that, and that one's been fairly popular too. So we have some. Gwendolyn at the back of the room there has got them. I guess we're supposed to go over to the merch section if we want to do commercial type stuff. But we do have some of the DVDs, and I'll offer them for like $5 a piece. I generally sell them for, I think, 12 on the website. But so anybody who's interested can find out more there. Scanimate.com, Scanimate.net. There's a lot more information on it, and I guess we're about out of time, so I'll open up the floor to any more questions. Got one right here? Okay.
When did this thing on? Okay. When did this thing kind of fall out of favor? When did it kind of like start to, when did the business kind of start to...
Well, you may have heard them mention in there a couple of times a device called the ADO. There was a famous paper presented at SIGGRAPH about a two-pass algorithm to warp a two-dimensional object or two-dimensional picture in perspective. And some guys that were pretty good math whizzes figured out how to implement it in hardware and convinced company called Ampex, which made the first 2-inch quad machines, to sell this thing, and they called it Ampex Digital Optics. And Ampex didn't really understand what they had, but it was digital. You could animate it with keyframes, it would move smoothly, you could zoom way in or way out, and it would hold up fairly well. And that right there was a lot of what Scanimate did, was just move things around on the screen. And so the ADO really was the first nail in the coffin. And about the same time, 3D graphics, the digital computers up to then had been really underpowered. There were no frame buffers. And so they began to gain enough power. Granted, they were still mainframes, but you could get enough power in a computer to where you could start to render things, store the frames, play them back, and have an animation. And that really began the second nail in the coffin. And but it, you know, it's really amazing. You can sit there with the Scanimate and have hundreds of parameters that instantly affect what you're seeing on the screen. And I mean, the second you touch the knob, it changes on the screen. And to this day, I'm constantly amazed. You can get the fastest computers you want, all these plugins that go with all these programs, and you use your mouse to point to a picture of a knob that you move a little bit, and then you sit there and wait, and then the picture changes, and you went too far. Well, that's not interaction. And when you get used to the Scanimate, where it's just immediate, it's like night and day.
So what year did this kind of start happening? Or what year did the Ampeg...
The ADO?
Yeah.
It really came into its own about 82, somewhere in there. So really between about 78 and 82, the eight Scanimates pretty much had the market. There was another question down here.
How did Computer Image how long did they stay in business as a company, having only moved eight units, and maybe did they develop further products?
Well, the short answer is they didn't. Mm-hmm. They had some real problems with money. The Scanimate sold for $1 million apiece. Mm-hmm. But one of the things they did early on was, as you saw her talk about, they wanted to move out to LA because they figured that's where the market is. They didn't have a clue how to get started in the business. And after a while, the bank said, okay, you've borrowed all this money, you built these machines, there's no money coming in, you're going to have to sell this. And so they went through their client list and said, well, here's your biggest client, sell it to them. So that took the rug out from under them too, because they lost not only their biggest client, but their big investment in trying to move into LA. Well, that company was Image West, and that's the company I went to work for. So I was faced with keeping these machines maintained and working, yet we weren't allowed to talk to Computer Image because they were the competition. So it was kind of an interesting job.
My little follow-up is, you know, so they did not, how much, was there any development, once someone bought a Scanimate, were there like new modules coming down? You know, did they add, were they extendable? And
initially they were extendable. A lot of the things they came up with as add-ons were, you may have noticed there was Roy was typing on something that was an Apple II. We came out with some A to D and D to A cards so that you could make little sparkles jump around and pinpoint exactly where on the screen they would light up. And it was the beginning, but the ADO and digital graphics pretty much took it away from us. So thanks for your attention. And like I say, Scanimate.com. And we've got some DVDs in the back if you're interested. Thank you.
And the Stearns room is open upstairs if you'd like to continue there. The Stearns room upstairs is open if you'd like to continue a discussion there.
Great. Thank you.